I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. We're offshore this time at Calabash, the Caribbean Literary Festival. It's an outdoor church of the written word, rocking and resonating on the south coast of Jamaica with the voices of poets and writers from Hong Kong, New York, Barbados, Nigeria, London, San Diego, and Boston among the home addresses. In this first of our conversations from Treasure Beach, Pico Iyer is preaching. All his life, the Dalai Lama has been friend and inspiration. Zadie Smith is a queen of his literary realm, and now Barack Obama is his global soul in the White House. Pico is our model of global attitude, in short. Born in England of Indian parents, he went to school and university in the United States and has lived 21 years now in rural Japan on a tourist visa. He begins here on why Jamaica feels not like the margin, but the center of the new century.
I see Jamaica as rivers from every corner of the world flowing together and forming entirely new combinations. And as we're sitting here, we can hear the sea crashing against the rocks 3 feet away from us. And I think if we were in New York or London, we wouldn't have 3,000 roaring people engaged and hanging on every word. This is a remarkable thing that people here have the hunger for the word as well as the appreciation of it.
Among other things, I've never heard such a resonant audience. It is literally a sounding board, and Robert Pinsky scored big, and you scored big, but they're listening, they're observing for something.
Yes, and you said it yesterday, and I just heard it right now as we were listening to Robert Pinsky. It's almost like here we are on a Sunday morning, and it's almost as if we're at church. And as he was delivering these high-flown, classical, eloquent poems, people say, yeah, bring it out. Wow. I mean, there were ripples through the crowd, which I've never heard at any literary festival before.
Oh, it has a lot to do with church.
Yeah. Yes, and it's a church of the word and the church of the spoken and the written word. And for writers and readers like you and me, that's the ultimate gratification. What a perfect way to spend a Sunday morning. And it's also, I was thinking yesterday, where we're sitting is sort of the place where art meets nature. Because as we look around us, all we see is this huge sky, the lineaments of the tropics, the sea at our feet. And yet against that, we have Robert Pinsky invoking George Herbert and the classics. And that's itself an interesting conjunction, I think. When I think of the West Indies, I think part of the beauty, often forgotten of this part of the world, is that two of the great recent Nobel laureates came from this area, V.S. Naipaul and Derek Walcott. And in both cases, what they really were doing, especially in Walcott's case, was to take the sea and the plants and the lush tropical foliage and bring it up against the Shakespeare and the King James Bible that he'd inherited, and so create a new language that nobody else has ever matched or begun to approach. And I think that's part of what's happening at Calabash.
Pico, all of that applies, and I feel also a confluence of the British imperial past and Africa offshore the Great Republic. I mean, it's something like the Allegheny and the Monongahela foaming the Ohio, but it's powerful and nothing much like it in the world.
No, it's very powerful, and I think there's a real relish for the word, partly because this is the only festival in the Caribbean, so people are coming from a long, long way away. But what Jamaica is about is creolization of the world. In some ways, Jamaica has for centuries been exactly what New York or Toronto or Los Angeles are becoming, which is the place where all the cultures get together and mix. And I think that you can see that in their palpable delight in language and the way that their own language is really, patois is a construct. It's a wonderful combination of what has never been brought together before.
Pico, this is why you're so rare. You're the man who lived in the Los Angeles airport for about 2-3 weeks and saw the future. And you think about identity, the dissolution of identity, the new identity, and what you call now the modern century. Take some of that apart. What are we talking about in terms of a new identity for all of us?
For all of us, I think it's certainly the global century. And what it really means is when people are asked that simplest of questions, where do you come from, they can't give a simple answer. And if they do give a simple answer, it's a false answer. And even somebody who is 100% Scotch, let's say, and living in New England, every time she walks down the streets of Boston, she's surrounded by the smells of Vietnam and the sounds of Persia and the rhythms and histories of Jamaica, perhaps, or El Salvador. And so it means that nobody is exempt, and everybody has to take the other into her life. And all our lives become that much richer for it. It also leads, of course, to deep questions about identity, because we don't have the firm foundations by which we could define ourselves the way we used to, our grandparents used to. But like any challenge, I think really it's a door opening. And I think English literature, for example, as well as world music and cuisine and everything we enjoy, is so much more fruitful and alive than when I studied it 30 years ago, when it was essentially Charles Dickens, Thomas Hardy, and maybe Trollope, all men virtually indistinguishable to me. And it's as if this stuffy house has had its doors and windows thrown open to receive these new smells and sounds and rhythms, and is infinitely more exciting now.
I'm glad you mentioned the books, because for me, the other piece that we left out of the Caribbean scene is the example of C.L.R. James. I don't know if he's one of your guys, but that Beyond a Boundary is, to me, one of the great modern books, built on his detesting the empire and oppression, as being a Pan-African black man, unlike Naipaul, who wanted to be, celebrated Toussaint, celebrated Haitian independence, and adored Thackeray, virtually memorized Vanity Fair, and adored cricket as pieces of England that he embraced more than the English, almost. But that paradox of being at home with the universal culture, so to speak, and militantly committed to his own identity, his own history, and to human equality, it seems to me that's somehow also the formula we're playing with here.
That's perfectly said, Chris. In fact, I was thinking that if you needed a tag for this festival, for me, to my surprise, it's really been The Empire Strikes Back. you and I were just listening to the readings from Braithwaite's book, To Sir With Love, which I've never read, and it's exactly the same thing. And it's, as you said, it's the Naipaul story, too, of these children of the empire who are made to think that Thackeray and Shakespeare and those were their gods, and they go to the center of the cathedral, England, and they find that their gods have been thrown out and that they're not welcome, and that some of the students who are most masters of the English language and of Shakespeare, who are from India and the West Indies and Nigeria and elsewhere, are suddenly having the door closed on them. And cricket is the perfect example. As you know, I was an interesting product of empire, child of Indian parents, born and raised in Oxford, England. And quickly I saw that cricket was what kept the empire going. But at the age of 7, I noticed all the best cricketers in the world were from the West Indies, and that they'd taken this quintessentially English product and created a revolution and played it with a style and panache that to this day you don't see in England except from people of West Indian background.
And James, C.L.R. James embraced all of that and thought that that line, it's not cricket, was almost enough we needed for a social morality.
That's right. And I think, I mean, C.L.R. James is a hero of mine, and partly what makes his response to empire so powerful, as with Derek Walcott or with V.S. Naipaul, is he was so eloquent. He'd completely mastered the language he'd been given, so he could speak back to his British masters as fluently as they had always spoken to him and his kin. And as we talk, I think of the very recent book, Netherland, by Joseph O'Neill, Irish person raised in Holland, coming to New York, using cricket as an example of how there's cricket all over New York, according to him, and it's where the people from the West Indies, especially, but India and elsewhere, create their own empires.
Marvelous book. And again, the vitality of that idea. But we're still stuck with those two questions that everybody asks in our world, and you've touched on them. First, where are you from? And second, what do you do? What do you say? I mean, they're terrible questions in a way, but start with them. What do you say now when people say, where are you from?
It really depends on who's asking. I feel I have 6 or 7 cards in my pocket, and I can play any one of them. And it's always interesting for me when I come to a literary festival like this. I'm always fascinated. Will they call me an American writer from Japan, an Indian writer from England, an English writer from America, a Japanese writer from India? Who knows? Any combination would apply. And, of course, all of them would be partial truths. And if you really ask me where I came from, it would have nothing to do with nationality. And I think passports are no more important than credit cards. People shuffle between them. I've had 3 different passports in my life. I could get a 4th. And really, to define oneself by one's nationality is to put oneself into a coffin. I don't think any of us really, or certainly I would never want to be known as as an Indian or American or British or whatever. None of those could begin to do justice to who I am. And, you know, I think part of the beauty of the modern century is our own president, is the living embodiment of that. To call him an American is to do injustice to at least 50% of his heritage.
He got away with an extraordinary formulation in Berlin during the campaign when he said, in effect, I greet you as an American man and fellow citizen of the world, and went right on. But he got a big response for it.
Yes, and so he took Ich bin ein Berliner from JFK and brought it into the 21st century and made it much more universal.
But so where do we go with that? Is there an alternative identity in this kind of oceanic feeling we get in Jamaica?
There is, because I think the new community is the community of the mixed up, or the community of the mongrel, which is to say that I, as an Indian born in England, raised in America and living in Japan, would instantly connect, and did connect over this weekend, with a Chinese person born in Kingston who happens to have been educated in Canada and is now working in India, perhaps. And half the people I've met in Jamaica come up to me and say, well, we know exactly what you're talking about because our home is dispersed across the planet, both in terms of the places that have made us, given us our blood, the places where we've lived, or the places where our loved ones are. We can't begin to pin it down. And so we know exactly what we're talking about, even though we've never been to Japan, we're not Indian, and we don't have an American passport, as you do.
That reminds me, I have to credit you with striking a tremendous chord with this Jamaican audience, and we listen carefully, and some do, some don't. It has nothing to do, apparently, with color or where you're from, but there are certain big themes, and Robert Pinsky hit them, and you hit them. I'm reminded of Zadie Smith's White Teeth, and there's a passage right in the middle of the book where she says, it was the century of immigration, and a confused time, but she sets it in a park, a public park in North London, Willesden, and there are children playing, and they have all these bumper car names, Kwame Leung and Isaac O'Rourke, and they're all colors and species. But she says, in that moment, she reflects that we're coming to the moment where we realize there's nobody more Indian than the Englishman, nobody more English than the Indian. And that book came out right before 9/11, but we seem to have stumbled and picked up the track again.
Yes, and I think we have to be much richer in our definitions. And people hyphenate themselves, but I think if you really want to come to a true definition of who you are, that would take a lifetime to formulate or to answer. And in fact, our identities are works in progress. They're like huge books that we're constantly adding to. And for example, as of this weekend, now Jamaica is a part of my identity. I'd never been here before, but now I have to put that little piece into the puzzle of Cuba and Thailand and Ethiopia and the other places I've been, out of which I make the stained glass hole that is my life or my identity. But yes, as you can tell, I'm not in favor of limitation. And I think what we're really seeing across the globe is a huge disjunction between the city and the country. And the global city, whether it's New York or Sydney or London, is made up of polyglots, or people from everywhere, who instantly can connect. So a Dominican in New York has much more in common with an Indian in New York than either of them have with somebody in Poughkeepsie, probably 100 miles away. In other words, there's this new transnational community that is alive in cities, and that's binding people much more together than the designation New York State or America.
Another piece of this for me is this growing awareness that we're all diasporas, and that, you know, we think of my people think of the Irish diaspora, Jewish diasporas, but the Jamaican diaspora is really extraordinary, all over the world, going many, many ways, not only to all the great track teams of the Olympics, every explosive runner, whether from Germany or Canada or the States or Jamaica itself, is Jamaican, it seems. But we're more and more aware of diaspora as the rule more than the exception.
Yes. Which is a wonderful thing, because it means our role models are different. If you're looking at sports, many a kid growing up today would say, I want to be Tiger Woods. Now, where does he come from? We couldn't say. If you're thinking of politics, anyone can grow up to be president, which is growing up to be a person half Kenyan, half American, who grew up in Indonesia and whose spiritual home is Hawaii, another blending of places. So yes, indeed, all the old definitions are gone. And people almost are living in the spaces between cultures or between definitions now. And I think that's a place of great fluidity, but also of great creative potential. That's why, that's what's revivified English literature, among so many other things, which it, I think when I was studying into the 70s, it got rather ossified. And now, when you have a Salman Rushdie or Zadie Smith, and writing in midair almost between England and America and Jamaica and India, and pushing these things together to create new combinations that literature has never seen before.
There are two people we have to invoke here. One is your friend, the Dalai Lama. The other is our president, Barack Obama. Zadie Smith also wrote, I think, the most powerful, maybe the only really penetrating commentary on Obama in that talk to the New York Public Library, in which she celebrated the mind of a novelist, but also a master of dialogues that he has no reason to speak, of languages, of tongues, of imagination. I want your take on Barack Obama.
Well, first, I just want to say I absolutely agree with you about Zadie Smith. When I read it, it was like a revelation. I pushed that essay on everybody. And part of the beauty of it was she brought her own experience to Zadie, to Obama, seeing how she has so many different registers. And she acquired an accent in university that would diametrically opposite from the one that she attaches to her parents. And then linked it up to Shakespeare, the great master of voices, and pointed out how these many-sided people, you can never see around them. It's just the way an octahedron is so much more interesting than a sphere, but you can never see the bottom of it, and you never get a grasp of it. And it's. I think when I used to study literature, there was always talk about the myriad-minded man or something like that. And Shakespeare and Obama and Zadie Smith clearly are examples of that. For me, part of the interest in Barack Obama is not the answers that he's providing, but the questions that he's embodying. Because I think the question that he addressed so rigorously and with such honesty in his first book, which is, who am I? How do I begin to put together all these different pieces? A piece in Kenya, a piece in Indonesia, a piece in Kansas, a piece in Hawaii. That is the question of the age. And so what he's asking about himself is exactly what the city of New York is asking about itself and most of our cities, and the whole U.S. is asking. The whole U.S. is made up of people from everywhere, and it has to bring them into a harmonious whole and create a direction out of it and not just a confusion. And I think in that sense, Barack Obama is the new America personified, because his issues, so to speak, are the country's issues. And I'm not looking to him to be a messiah, and I don't expect him to have every answer, but what I love about him is that he understands he doesn't have all the answers because he has so many sides to him. I think a previous president was very rooted in one piece of soil and had one perspective on the world. And I always felt that the world is too complex to be brought, to have only one perspective brought to it. Whereas Obama is himself a work in progress, is a moving target, as it were.
The only thing that makes me really nervous about him is that he may be the only person, except for Michelle perhaps, who has that imagination, that confidence in his own ability to ask the right question, to improvise his way toward an answer. We've got to somehow clone him and build that consciousness out, right?
We are cloning him. And as you said, I think Zadie Smith could understand why because she's from the same product. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Global Soul. And what I was defining in the year 2000, the third week of the millennium, was exactly the person we now have in our White House. And my sense was that with each generation, more and more kids are becoming Obamas, essentially. That more and more Americans, a typical American of Irish origin is probably marrying a typical American of Chinese origin now, and their children are going to be six times more international than the parents, and in sync with Obama. I think he's speaking for the future in that way. And when I go to a college campus now, I notice, compared with my generation, the kids are much more colorblind, and they don't even. And I say, oh, it's so wonderful that you, as a black man, have a Filipino on your arm or a German American. They hadn't even noticed. I'm thinking in those old categories, but as far as they're concerned, this is just another attractive classmate. And that's, I think, the world has really moved ahead in my lifetime in that way.
Zadie Smith also raised the question, though, about this novelist mind in the White House, that these may not be proven qualities for a politician. We don't quite know yet. What's your own thought?
Well, he is a master of nuance, and there are people who say that intelligent presidents of late have been our weakest presidents, and that it's better to know one wrong thing rather than to entertain 1,000 options, as perhaps an Obama might do. So I can see that point of view, and in fact, as you know, he begins his second book the audacity of hope by saying that when he entered politics, everyone came up to him, well-meaning people, and said, you seem like a nice guy, you seem like an intelligent, thoughtful guy, you seem like a guy who entertains nuance. Why are you in politics? That's, you know, doesn't exactly the qualities that we're not used to seeing in politics. But we've tried the alternative, and it hasn't worked so well. So I think he's really brought America into the global community, and America can now talk to other countries through him in a way that it couldn't before, because other countries are old countries, and old countries tend to be seasoned, nuanced countries who know that instead of black and white, it's infinite shade of gray. And I think he, though the world looks at him and sees this figure of youth and freshness, I think his particular strength is all the ancientness inside him, coming from Kenya and Kansas and other places, that he's not looking for easy solutions. He doesn't think that the world began in 1776, because it didn't for his people. And I think he's thinking in the same way that people in China or Nigeria or India or Guatemala are thinking, actually, because they have this much vaster canvas in terms of time and the past.
It's possible, it seems to me, as you speak, that he may talk to the world more successfully than he talks to our own country. How does his vision, his language, become somehow more familiar, starting with journalism? How does he get past this Republican suppose, or there's not enough money today, or we're worried about the economy or the job rate, and all these other things that define American politics?
No, I love your formulation, Chris. I think you're absolutely onto something. And like you, as a member of the media myself, I'm horrified at what the media is wreaking at the moment, which is to say, constant news to fill the 24/7 news cycle when nothing is happening in the world, which means every day we have to jump on one word of our president's and 3,000 people have to comment on it.
Will the closing of Guantanamo turn into a wedge issue with the Republicans or the right or the white or the wrong or whatever?
Or even smaller things like this. In a private meeting, he used the word bitter, or John McCain happened to use the word folly, or something. I mean, just tiny things. No one can withstand that scrutiny, not Jesus Christ or the Dalai Lama or Muhammad or anyone in the world. Nobody could withstand what's going on in the press right now. And I don't think the press is really entirely at fault, because the press is just giving people what they want, and what they want is constant bombardment of information from, and if the New York Times and Time Magazine are sometime employers, don't give them that. They'll turn to Entertainment Tonight or People or whoever will. And it's a terror. I mean, who would want to be an eminence or a celebrity or a leader in this climate? So you're right.
I'm not sure people want that. I think people want a chance to sit back and bask in the pleasure of contemplating this beautiful young man in power. Listen.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we're people being fed junk food who deep down are hungering for a three-course meal, as you say, over which we can linger, where we can have a real conversation with our friends, where we can savor every bite. So I do think people are crying out for the opposite. But we somehow got into this deranged, accelerated cycle where we're all the victims. And I think I loved what he said a year ago during the presidential campaign, which is, if we want, we can keep on parsing every syllable of everyone in the public domain forever, but we'll all be the losers if we do that. At some point, we've just got to take the larger vision. And he's done a wonderful job of doing that, but we've done a wonderful job of trivializing and demeaning what he says, I think.
What will it mean, Pico Iyer, for this man to talk with the world, as somebody said, instead of going out and trying to kill it? Somebody used that line and it got a wonderful sort of churchy roar from the crowd in Jamaica. Where do we begin? Do we have time to bring the heartbeat down that we're just talking with Iran, say, getting to know them?
Well, and I think it was Paul Holdengraber who said he's talking to the world instead of trying to kill it. And I said, even better, he's listening to the world rather than talking or lecturing to it, which I think is a great the great luxury that he's bringing. And you're right that the whole world is speeded up, but the only way that any peace can arise between nations is through a long, considered, contemplative conversation. And so if he goes to Iran and says, I don't have all the answers, I'm not going to tell you what to do, I want to hear your position and I want you to hear mine, that's a protracted procedure. Maybe that's a step back to the 1920s or something, but it's the only way that that agreement is going to arise. Because what we see when we turn on the TV now, or not the radio, but the TV, is people shouting at one another constantly. And I think Obama said over and over, we're crying out silently to be rescued from that, and the world is crying out for rescue, for a conversation instead of a shouting match.
I loved it the other day that he said, I don't watch cable television. Think of all the shouting matches he has missed.
Which is why he speaks with so deliberately, precisely, calmly, reassuringly, that he's bringing literally a voice that we want to hear, because it's not at fever pitch all the time, and it's not demonizing. I mean, in some ways, he's deconstructed the notion of enmity by expanding the notion of neighborhood. And he said that, you know, as the Dalai Lama does, since you mentioned him before, that the only enemy is that part of ourselves in our heads that thinks in terms of enemies. And we are ultimately the victim of that way of thinking. And I think Barack Obama and the Dalai Lama, you could take a speech from each and mix them up, and you wouldn't know which it came from. Their visions are so in sync.
Let's talk about it. The last time you and I spoke, we were reading your book, The Open Road, and noticing this incredible convergence around the New England Transcendentalists, especially Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman, who figure largely in your book, and it turns out in his mind. I'm dying to hear the Dalai Lama's, I mean, you channel him like nobody else, and you know him well. What is he thinking? What would he be saying to Barack Obama these days, do you think?
Well, I think, again, the Dalai Lama's great grace, like President Obama's, is that he loves to listen more than to lecture, and he loves to question more than to offer answers. And he always presents himself as a student in the world rather than a teacher. So I think if he and President Obama were to meet, as I hope they will do this October, we might have that interesting situation where each is asking the other and deferring to the other very much. But a few months ago, in July, in the run-up to the election, I was doing an on-stage event with the Dalai Lama at the Aspen Institute, and I tried craftily to ask him how he saw the presidential election. And, of course, he's much too diplomatic, and he wouldn't say whom he favored. But I asked him what we should look for in a leader, and he said, humility, listening to others, honesty. And in some ways, to my perhaps prejudice here, he did seem to be describing President Obama. Many people may not know that when President Obama took the oath of office, he had a scarf blessed for him by the Dalai Lama in his pocket, given to him by Dianne Feinstein and her husband, who are two of the oldest friends and supporters of the Dalai Lama in this country, who have been friends of his for more than 30 years. And as they were walking out for him to take the oath, they gave him the scarf and said, this traditional silk scarf has been given you for good luck from the Dalai Lama, and we'll keep it aside and give it to you afterwards. He said, no, I want it on my person when I take the oath. So he put it in his pocket. And I thought that might be an apocryphal story, but I heard it actually from Richard Blum, Senator Feinstein's husband, so he was there.
What does it mean?
It means that Barack Obama has always had, I think, a picture of Gandhi up in his office, which is probably the same picture that the Dalai Lama has in his office. And it means that both of them are looking to this much larger sense of community. And I was saying here at the festival how when the Dalai Lama won the Nobel Prize, he instantly gave some of the money to Mother Teresa, some to Africa, some to Costa Rica, as if to say, his community is not the Tibetans, it's the whole world. And I think that's exactly what Barack Obama is presenting. And I think they're both looking to somebody like Gandhi to say, we define ourselves by peace, tolerance, rigorous idealism, not by whether we choose to call ourselves Tibetan or Kenyan or something else. let's define ourselves by our values and where we're going, rather than by our parents' hometown.
That was another one of those moments, Pico, I have to say, in the audience where this whole Jamaican couple of thousand people resonated like a cello. When you spoke of the leader of world Buddhism not evangelizing for Buddhism, there was this wonderful kind of current of thank you.
I think all of us have had too much of evangelism or too much of other people's visions being pushed down our throats. And so I think one of the most refreshing things about him, one reason perhaps why the Dalai Lama is so popular across the planet, is that when he comes to Jamaica or California or Australia, he tells people, don't become Buddhists. Study within your own traditions, where you're not going to just grasp uncomprehendingly at some exotic tradition, and where your roots are really deepest. In India, they always say, much better to dig one 60-foot well than 10 6-foot wells. And I think that's part of what's And also, he's seen over 25 years so many people perhaps running prematurely to Buddhism, attracted by what's great in it, but not really understanding everything that's involved in it. And we don't hear many religious figures telling people not to join their religions.
But what does that tell you about identity? Draw on your own well.
That's right. Don't be too promiscuous. As the danger in this world is that we can pick up a little Buddhism here and a Sufism over there, which is so attractive, and we may come from a Catholic family, and we can't help practicing yoga and absorbing Hinduism. And so before we know it, we've lost our sense of where we belong. And I think, for example, the Dalai Lama's great joy when he travels is to talk to Catholics, Muslims, Muslim clerics, Hopi leaders, and violently agnostic scientists or atheistic scientists. And he says that to talk to any one of them deepens his understanding of Buddhism. He needs to be challenged and he needs to hear other perspectives.
Coming back to Jamaica, Pico, there's another piece of this perspective that I think enchants us. It reminds me of something Bongo Jerry Small, a writer, performer here, said to me several years ago. But he said basically that that Pan-African reggae, call it what you will, perspective that defines Jamaican thinking is here forever, or as long as people are suffering in the world. You're talking here to well-off Jamaica, but this community seems to have a kind of inbred understanding of the other in the world, the disadvantaged, the poor, the suffering, the hungry, and they remind us of how to have it in mind all the time.
And they are, as you say, the great majority of the transnational people crossing boundaries are the most vulnerable and most undefended. I think there are now, by some counts, 200 million displaced people in the world. And I wouldn't even call myself displaced because I'm, as you say, one of the fortunate few. But the people who are really thinking about how to construct a sense of home and of self and identity and community in a foreign place are usually the people who are in a foreign place out of necessity and not of choice, including, of course, the Tibetan exiles, but exiles from everywhere. And I think that's where the questions are most intense. And in some ways, the Obamas of the world or the Picos of this world, who are among the fortunate few, are trying to help formulate answers that will help the vast majority who have been pushed out by poverty or famine or war, find themselves in a place they never wanted or expected to be, and now have to constitute an identity and a life there. They don't have the luxuries, as you say, that we do. And it's wonderful to come to Jamaica because I think, as you say, all the people here, their ancestors never wanted to be here, but willy-nilly were thrown into the conundrum of how are you going to put Africa, the Caribbean, and the British Empire into the same sentence and make it sing and make it rhyme.
One other little point I want to throw out for rebuttal or comment. One of the things I love about Jamaica is that it reminds me somehow of Ireland. It is this island, offstage, the great empire, very penetrating view of greatness and a kind of freedom from doing all those nasty things that empires do. But sometimes, actually, Jamaicans sound like Irish people, but this Jamaicans are somehow to the States and the modern empire what the Irish grew up being backstage of the British Empire. Small wonder that they produced, shall we say, a lot of the greatest English writers, too.
And musicians, in both cases. That's a wonderful parallel. I've only been in Jamaica 2 days, and I've never been in Ireland, so you're the one I would defer to on that. But it's wonderful that an Irish writer, Joseph O'Neill, wrote the great Caribbean book, the great book about Caribbeans in New York. And I think that comes out of exactly that parallel, the Irish always feeling they're on the margins of empire and pretty much its victims, and therefore a kinship with, I know the Indians during the independence time, oddly enough, in New York, formed a team with the Irish, because they said, we know what you've been through and you can lead us in our freedom struggle. And the Jamaicans would be another piece of that whole puzzle. I mean, I sometimes call the British Empire the real World Wide Web of the 19th century, that in fact was stitching together all its subjects into this community whereby so many of the Jamaican people I've met in the last few days, I think, would instantly understand what an Indian person feels like or an Irish person. And in fact, like any slightly strict father or government, it has tied together all its subjects in a revolution against it in some way.
Pico, obviously you've got to go to Ireland, but I was going to say you've been everywhere, and you've been a pathfinder, so many places. What keeps you moving? What are you looking for out there or in here in your work now? You're still a young man.
Not so young, but I think it's very much in here now. You're right. I mean, I've been lucky enough to see most of the countries I've always dreamed of. But the inner exploration is inexhaustible. And I must say I do a lot of my travel now at my desk, just in memory and imagination, trying to piece together the places I've been and turn them into a pattern or a whole.
Describe that desk. Take us into that room.
You'd be horrified, Chris, if you saw my desk, because I live in a two-room apartment in rural Japan. No car, no bicycle, no TV, no real internet, no newspapers, no magazines. And I share a young girl's desk. My stepdaughter's gave me her desk, so she used to go to school and I would use her desk, but that's the only place I have to write at. I've been in Japan for 21 years on a tourist visa. I don't speak much Japanese, but for many reasons, including those, it's a wonderful way for going deep, 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 free from the distraction of the talk show, the latest bulletin, the cell phone, and the television. I can really lose myself in a parallel world for months at a time. And I think what I'm trying to do is exactly what you were saying earlier, which is to step back from the cacophony of the culture and just ground myself, steady myself, and then try to make sense of it. Because I used to live in New York, and I could see that life was just getting too dizzying. Too much was coming in on me, and I didn't have enough time to process any of it. So I've taken this rather radical move of living in the most foreign country I know in this very simple, small space to try to make sense of the world.
Can it be done? I was in my own sort of Thoreau cabin last weekend in rural New Hampshire, very rural New Hampshire, with nothing but a view, and I was thinking, could I do it? Could I live here?
Well, as I listened to myself, I realized I was describing Thoreau's cabin, wasn't I, in his 21st century incarnation, which is a Western-style modern apartment named after Elvis Presley's birthplace, the Memphis Apartments in rural Japan. But I think not only can it be done, but it needs to be done. Obviously, I'm a curious person because I'm an only child. I grew up 6,000 miles from my parents and my grandparents and uncles and aunts, and so I've always been used to being by myself, and I like being on my own in some very foreign culture, and that's not for everybody, of course. But anyone who is moved by Thoreau can certainly find their own version of Walden Pond in the world. And I think what he was crying out in 1850 is, as the telephone and the train were just coming into Massachusetts, and he realized that they were going to propel us along a path we hadn't chosen, he wanted to rebel against that, to be a civil disobedient against that. And I think whatever he was rebelling against is 40 times more intense now, and there's a 40 times greater need to unplug, to bring ourselves away, if only to return to the world with a clearer sense of direction and priorities.
Pico Iyer, sum it up in some fashion. We're inhaling Jamaica, a transnational spirit, the English word, the Obama future. How do we savor it? How do we remember it? How do we mark it? And I ask that kind of seriously. We need this.
I've been thinking that in some ways we're in the center of the word and the center of the world now. When I was born, everyone would say the center of the world was London or New York. And the world has grown so much more interestingly complex so quickly that a literary event here, as I was saying before, finds a much larger audience than a literary event in London or New York would. That a 21st century novel is much more likely to be set in Bombay than London or New York. I think of London as the capital of 19th century novel, New York the capital of 20th century novel, and Bombay, by which I also mean Kingston and Port of Spain and maybe Lagos and other places, Lahore, those are the capital of the 21st century novel in the English language. And what we're seeing is that I think I, before coming to Jamaica, might have thought of it as a marginal place. Now that I've been here, I can't say that. It's not the margins. You're right that it's on the edge of the great America, as Ireland's on the edge of Britain, but it's as central as New York. The same number of influences coming. Here's you, an Irish-American person, and here's me, an Indian-Japanese person. We're converging by the sea in Jamaica, surrounded by other mongrels like ourselves, and the conversation is going to be at least as rich here as in New York, but perhaps richer. And I think we can't talk anymore about a center of empire and a victim of empire. That the empire is global, and Jamaica is having its say to London and New York, and London and New York has to attend to it. And it's interesting that the writer that I think you and I have most celebrated during this conversation, Zadie Smith, is half Jamaican, half English. She lives in New York. But she, in her life, is a way of saying, because she's such an accomplished novelist and essayist at her young age, I am going to bring my Jamaican heritage, as well as my English and American heritage, into the center of Western thinking, in the center of Western writing, in exactly the same way as Barack Obama willy-nilly is bringing Kenya into the White House and into the center of traditional power, so that the Kenya now can say, we have a guy in the White House, the most powerful man in the world is from our little tribe. They can legitimately say that as much as somebody from Kansas can say it. And I think Jamaica now is empowered in that same way. They can say that one of the most exciting novelists in the English language, Zadie Smith, it's coming from Jamaica and is channeling Jamaica into and bringing it together with her English part and now her American life. And I think that's the excitement, that Jamaica is now a center of the world, and there isn't the center of the world. There isn't one center of the world. The center of the world is everywhere.
I love it. I love the center of the word, too. Pico Iyer, it's a joy, it's a pleasure, it's a personal treat to share with you and gab and listen. Thank you so much. Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Pico Iyer. It's the first of several from the Calabash Festival over the U.S. Memorial Day weekend in Jamaica. On this hybridizing, creolizing world of languages and identities reinventing themselves, feedback with your own piece of the stained glass mirror at our site, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Wherever you're from, wherever you're at, thank you for joining us.